You're listening to Radio Reverb's coverage of the general election. To hear interviews with all the main parties standing in the area, the Brexit Party, the Conservatives, Green, Labour, and the Liberal Democrats, go to RadioReverb.com and find The Politics Show.
This is the sound of politics in your city. The Politics Show with Geoffrey Bowden on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM.
Hello, this is Geoffrey Bowden on 97.2 FM, DAB and RadioReverb.com. And this is the second programme in our general election specials. And this time, on the end of the line, is a member of the Green Party. Is that Ollie Sykes?
Yes. Hello. Hi, Geoffrey. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Now, some people will be familiar with your name. Just remind listeners why they might be familiar with your name.
Well, I'm not the leader of the popular beat combo, Bring the Horizon. I was a Brighton Hove City Councillor for 8 years, from 2011 to this year, to 2019. And obviously during that time, I was part of the Green administration from 2011 to 2015, and I was the finance lead for the Green Group.
Okay, so well, that's your political past, and who knows, it might be your political future, but on a bigger stage. So tell me a little bit about Ollie Sykes, the man. I mean, voters vote as much for the man as they do for the party. What's your background?
Well, going back, I'm a scientist by academic background. I've got a degree in biochemistry and a couple of master's degrees in environment-related stuff. So I did a master's in aquatic biosciences at Queen Mary and Westfield College in London. And then I've worked in overseas development for some time on the back of that. And then I pursued another master's in environmental assessment and management in Brighton, at the University of Brighton, in the mid-noughties. Worked in consultancy for a while and currently working at the Environment Agency as a project manager.
Oh, well, so in the words of the old BT ad, you've got lots of ologies there. I should just explain to listeners who may hear you fading in and out, you're actually not in the luxurious environment of the Radio Reverb studios in the heart of Brighton Open Market. You are calling us almost from foreign parts in downtown Worthing, where you work. So just to explain why you might be fading in and out. We're getting the message. So you are an environmentalist, so no surprise then that you are standing for the Green Party. For many years, the Green Party was known by, well, the jibe was to from the other parties that we're only interested in one issue. But all of a sudden, they all seem to have either adopted green trees as their symbols or what look very much, from my memory, look like green policies. Like the Green New Deal seems to be everyone's policy now. Before, it seemed to be a pet hobby horse for the Green Party alone. So does that annoy you that they're jumping on the bandwagon? Was that all part of recycling?
Yeah, all for recycling, including of ideas. No, I mean, there's a sort of a general rule in life. When it comes to ideas, be proud to pinch. You know, if someone's had a good idea, don't be afraid to use it. So I haven't got a problem at all with other parties adopting Green Party ideas, whether it be on the Green New Deal or the 4-day week or numerous other policies. I mean, what I do worry about is how deep that adoption goes, and whether it is in fact just for electoral purposes. So, I mean, what one clear example, I suppose, is the declaration of climate and biodiversity emergencies, which has happened at a national level in the UK and also at local authority level all over the country by Labour administrations, and I think by Tory administrations as well.
So, do you think they're jumping on a sort of a climate emergency bandwagon, and they're doing it?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, our very own council, Brighton and Hope Council, we declared a biodiversity and climate emergency. I led on that just under a year ago. And very, very little has been done in concrete terms to follow up on that. The point of doing that was to raise the profile, but also to set in train policies, allocate budgets, recruit people. You remember yourself, maybe, Geoffrey, when the Greens were in administration, one of the first, our first budget, I think, suffered £150,000 cut by Labour and Conservatives to the council sustainability team. Our council sustainability team now has far fewer people than all neighbouring authorities, despite the fact it is supposedly, you know, left of centre and green. And so,
aren't the Greens in some kind of loose cahoots with the Labour administration? There's you seem to have agreed a set of core issues that you can't get a cigarette paper between the two parties, and you're kind of working together. Is that not right, or have I misread it?
No, I mean, I think that's what I understand. Obviously, I'm not a member of the council at the moment, so I'm not following the precise details about how that works. I think the problems with that are that we're in a very polarised political time. The Labour Party itself is highly split. And even if there is a loose arrangement between Labour and Greens on key issues, I think there is still a huge problem in implementing a lot of stuff. And I'll give you one very specific example, which I found extremely frustrating. And it sort of goes back to when I was a councillor and the last budget. We had approved by everybody an amendment to put £190,000 back into the sustainability team to work on precisely these issues, to work on climate change mitigation, climate change adaptation, biodiversity, all that stuff. And I asked a question at last full council on the 24th of October and found out that pretty much nothing has been done, despite the fact that that money is available to be spent on this work. And what's the point of declaring a climate and biodiversity emergency? What's the point of signing up to that if the Labour administration aren't going to do anything with money that's sitting there waiting to be spent?
So do you think then...
I'm annoyed.
I think even with the poor line, we get that. That comes all across in spades. But, I mean, do you just think that the other parties have looked at the Extinction Rebellion rallies and protests and said, oh, we need to be down with the kids. And, you know, got this teenager coming over from Sweden. We need to be aligned with that to get votes. Is that your reading of the whole... other parties' agenda on climate change?
I'm sure there is. There is some of that. I think, but when parties come out with statements like, "Oh, you shouldn't be striking on Fridays; you should be striking on Saturdays," I think that somehow misses the point of the whole climate strike movement. And possibly other political parties are conscious of moves by the Greens and others to push for a voting age to be brought down to 16. And they're also very aware that young voters, more than any other cohort, are registering to vote now. I think sort of 300,000 in the past couple of weeks or something, 18 to 24-year-olds have registered to vote. So clearly, you know, young people nowadays, far from being apathetic, have been really inspired by Greta Thunberg, by Extinction Rebellion, and they're telling us what to do. And we see that all over the place in the course.
Do you think, I mean, it's a question I've asked other candidates I've interviewed. What do you think this general election is about? Is it about climate change, or is it about Brexit?
Well, unfortunately, we can't avoid Brexit, can we? And I've just got to, you know, it's so sad that, you know, for the past 3 years or more, we've just had our politics dominated by this. And, you know, despite the way it looks now, prior to 2016, people were not talking about the European Union over breakfast, were they? They were talking about jobs, housing, the economy, the NHS, schools, roads, public services. Well, they weren't talking about the minutiae of the European Union.
Now, here we are, talking about the pros and cons of it after three years. Now, of course, you're getting the full English Brexit.
Yes, and then, I mean, the Greens have said for ages, what we don't want a general election is not going to solve this. I mean, there's a higher risk we end up with a hung parliament, and then what? What we've said since 2016 is that we need a second referendum, people's vote, final say, call it what you will, between a deal that's been struck and Remain. Okay. Unfortunately, we have a general election, so obviously Brexit's going to be a key.
All right. Well, Parliament, before it stopped everything, all the discussion on this new deal that Boris Johnson was waving like a prime minister coming down the steps of a plane from Munich with his white piece of paper. He was saying, look, this is the deal. And Parliament actually passed it with the support of some Labour MPs by 30-odd votes. So there is a deal there. What is the Green Party's attitude to the current deal that's on the table?
Well, I think it's an appalling deal. When you look at it, it's got a huge bear trap in it, which goes straight to no deal at the end of 2020. And Johnson has recently come out and said absolutely categorically that there'll be no further extensions beyond the end of 2020. And the way the deal was rewritten following Theresa May's deal was to remove some of the workers' rights and environmental protections from the withdrawal agreement, put them into the political agreement, which is not binding, of course. So, I mean, we think it's an awful deal. And, I mean, I suppose my preference in a referendum would be for a milder form of Brexit to be the one choice and Remain to be the other. Because, I mean, I think in many ways the deal comes close to being the no-deal Brexit that some want with you know, it's just obviously with a bit of time lag in it, if you like.
It sounds a bit like, and I don't know whether this is official Green Party policy or not, that you're kind of slightly in tune with the Labour Party view, which is a new deal needs to be negotiated and then put to the people to decide. Because you clearly don't sign up to the, or the Green Party doesn't sign up to the current deal that was on the table before everything was stopped in its tracks and a general election was voted for.
I think the choices before us would have to be choices that minimise the damage to the country in terms of economy, environment, you know, social protections. And so I think, I mean, if it were to come to that, I think the options on the ballot paper in a people's vote, my preference would be something like the deal that May struck with the modifications subsequently negotiated by, you know, the Keir Starmer-led group in Labour before May was deposed. So I mean that would approach,
but that, but that's, my but that's preference. Surely not on the table. And Keir Starmer, there's the, you know, may not be in Parliament anymore, we've got a deal that's been floating around that's had kind of in principle agreement from a Parliament, albeit now prorogued and fighting people fighting for their seats and new candidates. So about 60 people aren't standing again. So we'll have a new parliament. If the Tories have a majority, they can push through this agreement, surely. And then the idea of a people's vote is completely null and void.
No, that's the case. But I mean, it's you know, politics is nothing if not unpredictable at present. You know, we don't know the outcome of a general election. It might be that the trajectory post general election is such that there's some leverage to improving the improving the deal that's on the table against Remain. I mean, if that's not possible, maybe there'll be leverage towards a people's vote. I mean, we will just keep pushing for a people's vote. I think that's absolutely key. We've all learned so much more in the past 3 years since the referendum about what Brexit means and the damage that it can cause for our country and our country's standing in the world. And so, I mean, if it is Johnson's deal against Remain on the ballot paper, then so be it. But you know, we will keep pushing for a people's vote.
But of course, if Johnson gets his party gets a majority, there won't be an option of a people's vote. They just want to get on with it, and then we've got years of negotiation ahead of us for some kind of deal on our trading relationships with the EU. So,
well, indeed, I mean, years of negotiation, but I mean, according to the current documents, we have until the end of 2020 to get a trade agreement, and after that we drop out. So. But obviously dropping out doesn't just mean dropping out. There is no such thing as a clean Brexit. After that, you go into, as you say, years of negotiating to work out trade deals based on, initially WTO terms. So, I mean, the whole thing is an appalling mess. And Cameron really threw a hand grenade into UK politics and the country, to be quite frank.
And then turned on his heel and whistled off into the blue horizon.
slunk into his shed. To
write a book. But it just sounds from what you're saying then, although there is this Extinction Rebellion movement, climate change is more present and endangering the whole of mankind, Brexit is kind of blotting out any other issue. So let's find and test you on what other issues are the Greens' key battle points. So NHS, are you against it being privatised? Social care, all these sort of things that people have just not been thinking about because of the megaphone that the Brexit has put into our society. So what are the other policies that the Greens would espouse?
Well, I mean, I think we did talk briefly about the climate and the environment, but I mean, I think that for us is the other absolutely critical issue in this election. This is the climate election, if you like. If we have a government that's in place now for 5 years, That'll be half of the 10 years that we have left, according to the UN's IPCC, to do anything about climate change and about reaching 2 degrees above 1990 levels of global heating. So climate change is absolutely critical in this election, and we really mustn't forget that. And you asked me about what drives me in my politics, and I was just thinking back to my childhood and how in our lifetime the climate has changed. I grew up in North London, and I can remember one February or March when in North London, where you hardly ever see snow down nowadays, our school was shut for a month because of snowfall, and we had a foot of snow in
Don't tell me in August. I hope not.
You might see that now. But I mean, this is the shifting baseline. We've all witnessed it. We've all witnessed the decline in wildlife.
Yes.
When was the last time you saw a hedgehog? I don't know. And in a way, it sort of happens slowly, so we don't immediately register. But if I think back to my childhood. You think back to yours, Geoffrey. No, that wasn't.
No, that's in the last century. Listen, Ollie, I would love to go back into my past. And before the lights do go out as a result of climate change, I'm going to ask you to sign out with your choice of music. And perhaps you'd like to just tell listeners what you've selected. And this may have a familiar sound to some people who've heard you on this channel before.
Well, I don't know. I think it's a wistful piece of music by a Cape Verdean musician called Cesaria Evora, who died maybe 10 years ago. She was discovered as a club singer at the age of 40.
Okay, we're fading that.
And the tune's called Saudade. It's I'm a loserphile. I love Portuguese language and culture. So it's
great. Thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. Pleasure.
Okay, and joining me now is Lloyd Russell Moyle, MP of this parish. You're standing again in Brighton Kemptown, which you won last time. I mean, we've had so many elections. Just remind listeners when you were elected.
2017, the last general election, but it feels like a lifetime ago in many respects.
Well, you certainly made a name for yourself in a very short time. People will have seen you doing all sorts of crazy things in Parliament. Well, probably not crazy, but certainly drawing attention to some of the nonsense that goes on.
Well, Parliament has become a particularly bizarre place where laws can be broken, like illegal prorogations, and you're helpless to do anything in Parliament apart from protest. That's what Caroline and I did with that. We held down the Speaker. I lay over his lap, as is the President. The last time a prorogation was stopped was by an MP lying on the MP at the Speaker's lap. So I told John Bercow, well, I've looked into the history books and this is the last time it happened, John. I have to inform you I'm going to lie on you. And he said, oh, that sounds awfully fun.
Well, he's a very liberal-minded guy.
Yes, yes. And then, of course, we've seen not only the Brexit stuff, but a number of areas where the Conservatives have failed to meet up to expectations, you know, whether it's on sexuality education, where they've ended up making a rod for their own back by, rather than just enforcing it as there was a consensus to do so, they've said yes, it should be included, but you need to consult with parents first. But if the parents say they don't like it, you still got to teach it. So you just are creating a kind of forum for homophobia to suddenly bubble to the surface. The same with kind of the Gender Recognition Act. Oh yes, we're going to change something, but we're not going to tell people how it's going to change. So in that vacuum of lack of leadership, you have a rising transphobia in our communities that affects our area. So what you see one after another is not just on Brexit, but on lots of areas, lack of leadership, which leads us on this side of the benches, the opposition side, to almost go crazy with frustration.
Do you think, though, that the antics that have been going on, and you know, if you look at the viewing figures for the Parliament Channel, it's gone out of the roof, and it's not just in this country, because I've visited and I do a lot of work in Europe. People are absolutely glued to it, and people's reaction to it is mixed, to say the say the least, because they look at our arcane procedures. And they see this paralysis. And I'm just wondering whether on the doorstep your experience has been that people are completely apathetic and are perhaps feeling, you know, a plague on all your houses.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. The Parliament Channel was about to be shut down 2 years ago because they didn't have enough viewing numbers. And in the height of the viewing figures at the moment, it gets 1.5 million people watching it a night. It's rather amazing.
But I mean, do you think it's...
But I think... What has happened is those 1.5 million people that are now glued to it and viewing it are probably people like you and I, who are interested in politics anyway, and it's channeled and fueled that. But people who are actually interested in getting on with their day-to-day lives, who want to see things changing in their communities, it suddenly puts them off. It becomes a kind of real Marmite effect, and they kind of say, well, actually, I think all of you are just messing about. I don't see a difference between Boris or you, because you're all just playing games in this place and you don't care about my world. And that's why, of course, the doorstep conversation is really important, to say about the hope and vision of what Labour's going to do, to say we agree that the country has been broken. You only need to walk up St James's Street and see the number of people sleeping in shop doors in an evening, and know that this country is deeply broken, and it's broken by 9 years of austerity and the Conservative government with Liberal support at the early days. And it's broken because the country has not had vision and direction of how we need to restore pride in ourselves. And to many respects, Brexit and all the paralysis that we've had in politics is not the cause of our problems, but it is a ginormous symptom of the bigger problem that we have, which is a country where large numbers of people feel that the state doesn't work for them anymore.
But, I mean, that said, what has dominated for the last 3 years is a single topic. Mm-hmm. And maybe the Tories have got a point of saying, just get Brexit done, which is like a snappy little phrase, and everything will be all right. But is it drowning out all these other issues that you've just talked about? The NHS, social care, the environment, all these things seem to be completely put on the back burner, and Brexit seems to be the dominant theme of this election. So much so that as we record it, We started out this series of election specials with the Brexit Party standing, or threatening to stand, 600 candidates. Now it's down to 300-odd. And they're going to be targeting wards, constituencies such as your own. So it's still there. And do you think people are swallowing this idea that if they only vote for Tory, then they can just move on?
Some people are. People want to move on. I think that is clear. They don't want to just talk about Brexit. Some people, of course, are concerned about Brexit, and I'm very concerned as a Remainer. But they want to move on in a way that will start addressing their concerns. And what we must say and convince people is that Brexit will not be solved by some temporary deal. All Boris is offering is an 18-month transition arrangement, and then it will all start again. All those arguments that we've had for the last 3 years, all the parliamentary shenanigans, all the arguing with Brussels going back and forwards, insulting our friends and allies over the river, all of that will continue for years and years under Boris. And of course, he's not telling people that. And of course, what we need to do is say Boris's deal is a deal for perpetual negotiations, constant negotiations, either with Europe or with other trading partners. And our arrangement, which will be going back to the people, I will be campaigning for Remain. That is the only way of ending this Brexit nightmare, and then starting to solve the causes of Brexit, which is this inability for the country to feel like it is working for the right people.
I mean, can I just ask you, because it won't have, people won't have missed the fact that you appear to have been out of step with your leadership, because you've been campaigning for People's Vote for some time, very openly, along with a number of people on the Labour front bench. But the Labour Party seems to have a slightly odd and difficult to sell position, in that they're going to renegotiate and then put it back to the people, and then there's a possibility they might actually campaign to reject the renegotiated deal that they've put. That seems like a very difficult position on the doorstep.
It's only difficult if you say it's difficult. The idea that we're going to have a referendum within 6 months to put an end to this is, of course, similar to what the Greens are offering. Liberals, are offering to revoke, which is dangerous, because actually you revoke one way and that means you get Tories in the next time and they will crash us out of Europe without a referendum. It removes any safeguard of going back to the people. But our policy is, within 6 months, you go back to the people. You can only go back to the people with a deal. You can't offer Remain versus Remain. So you have to put a deal in front of those people. Our view is it would be absolutely reckless to put forward Theresa May's or Boris Johnson's deal, because we've talked about the disaster that that is. So we have to try and negotiate the very best possible deal that's on the table. It's not going to be a Labour deal, but it's going to be trying to find a deal that is the very nearest to something that we could swallow and accept. And then we will put that back to the people with the envelopes written up already, one that says the deal that we were able to get, the other that says Remain. The civil servant will have the mandate to literally send that letter to Brussels after the results come in that evening, and that is the end. No more debate, because it's a worked up deal that's a finality, not just Johnson's 18-month deal, it's a final deal of the final settlement of where we want to be versus, and Boris's deal is only a transition deal, so that's why you can't put Boris's deal to the people, because actually it's not the final say, it's not the where we are, a Labour deal of a final or a Remain deal. And I don't think that final say, that final deal from Labour that we'll negotiate will meet the six tests of the Labour Party. And the Labour Party's been clear, we will only campaign to support a deal that meets our six tests. I don't think that's now possible, and that's become not possible because of where Europe is, because of where Britain is, because of the changing circumstances. But also, I don't think you can just say we're going to put forward a deal that's not actually worked up, that's not actually legally binding, because then we will end up with the whole drama all over again. And that's what Boris is offering. That's actually, to some extent, what the Liberals are offering, because it will all then be brought back to Parliament to negotiate. But the point of a final say deal is that it's the final say, and that's why you have to work up a deal.
But from what you're saying, it sounds like you're not hopeful that we'll get a a deal that's negotiated by a Labour government that will meet all your six tests. In which case, how will a Labour government that has just negotiated a deal and spent how many months negotiating?
3 months.
3 months. How will they then campaign? Will they campaign in favour of this new deal that they've got, or will they campaign to remain?
I will campaign for remain.
And Labour, I know what you will, but what will the Labour?
Labour has said very clearly, we will campaign to remain against a bad deal or no deal. And a bad deal is one that doesn't meet the six tests.
Okay, so...
I think that's pretty simple. The six tests we laid out in the last election, this isn't a new thing that we've just come up. And how we got to those six tests, let's be very clear. They weren't just things that we plucked from the air. They were things that we listened to the Leave campaign. All those promises. Now, I think they were fantasy promises, but they were promises. They were effectively the manifesto of Leave were given to the country. That was the basis of the Leave result. And so therefore, we will say to the people, you didn't just vote for any kind of Leave. The Leave campaign put forward an option, which is that you'd have a good trade deal, that you'd have continued relations with Europe, that you would have, you know, kind of a Norway, but even better, all these things. It wouldn't affect the Good Friday Agreement. Northern Ireland would remain intact. Those are about our six tests. And you say, this is what Leave promised you. We will try and achieve a negotiated settlement that Leave promised you. I don't think it's possible. We don't think it's possible. But we will give it a stab. And then we will put the nearest thing possible to that back to you to decide whether actually it did meet the Leavers' promises or whether you prefer to remain. Now, Labour campaigned to remain in the referendum. We don't own those six tests, but they are the distillation of those promises that were made. And we say there is no democratic legitimacy to leave the European Union unless it can meet those six promises.
OK. I mean, a lot of Labour areas, and this may be going back to your point about the divided society and the government actually not looking after mm-hmm. all our population, voted quite overwhelmingly against remaining. They wanted to leave. How does that fit in with their democratic choice at the referendum, that if you're kind of ignoring what they said, and aren't those people going to be attracted to a Brexit candidate standing in their constituency?
Well, let's be clear. 2-1, it was Conservative versus Labour voters that voted to leave in that referendum. Mm. So only 1/3 of the Leave voters are Labour supporters nationally. And even in the most Brexity of seats, it doesn't mean that everyone in that seat voted to leave. And of course, in those seats, the majority of Remainers voted Labour. And the majority of Leavers in those seats didn't vote Labour. Now, all that's happened, of course, is that whereas previously the votes were split, so Labour got in those safe seats because the Remain, Progressive votes, plus some of the Leave vote managed, they got a block. And the Conservatives were split with UKIP and were split with all these other parties. There is, of course, a danger that the Leave groups now unite in those constituencies versus a splintering of Liberal, Green, Labour on the other side. And that is a danger in those seats.
So, I mean, let's take it down to your own constituency, mm-hmm. because we now know that the Brexit Party is going to be going after your vote, mm-hmm. principally, which will play how? Because you've got... you didn't have a Green candidate stand against you last time. They stood down.
And we didn't have a UKIP candidate.
And you didn't have a UKIP
candidate. And we had in Brighton Kemp Town, people need to remember this, Brighton Kemp Town had two UKIP councillors until 2015.
But they were defectors. They weren't elected.
No, they were elected UKIP over in Peacehaven.
Peacehaven's not part of Brighton City Council, is it?
No, but it's part of Brighton Kemp Town
constituency. Oh, the constituency,
yes.
I bow to your knowledge of your own constituency.
But this is the problem. A lot of people in Brighton Kemp Town, in Queen's Park, in Kemp Town Village,
all those comfortable areas,
in Molscombe, in Whitehawk, they think, oh, well, we're just part of the city, and clearly it's going to be Labour. We've not got to worry about anything here. My constituency goes all the way to the border of Newhaven. And in Peacehaven, we had two county councillors until that were UKIP, and we had town councillors that were UKIP. We had a town councillor that was UKIP until he resigned only last year, and we managed to replace him with a Labour person. Now, of course, there's a sea change. In Peacehaven, we now have, for the first time ever, a Labour mayor. In Telscombe, for the first time ever, we have a Labour mayor. We have managed to make inroads, and we have shown people the positive that Labour can do. But we're quite right. There is a real danger that Labour gets squeezed on the Brexit side. The reality is, with any hardcore Brexiteer who wants no deal, Labour is not going to please them. We're not going to please them because we're not a no-deal hard Brexit party. And what all we can do is say to them, ignore Brexit, look at the other positive stuff that we're going to do. But I'm not going to compromise on the Brexit side with them. The other problem that we face, however, though, is on the side where actually we agree on Brexit and where we agree on most of the social policies and where we agree on actually needing to transform our country and spend billions, if not trillions of pounds, transforming our economy so it's a green economy, getting rid of, in my area, my speciality is the arms trade, getting rid of the arms trade and transforming it into kind of renewables sector. We have seen in this country wind turbine factories shut down rather than open up in the last 15 years. This is a disgrace that needs an absolute change. Labour is committed to it. And the difficulty is that we are fighting between parties that kind of agree on 90% of our policy. And so you could end up with a situation where Brexit and Tories squeeze through the middle in Kemp Town and the rest of us are all splintered. And I remember in 2015, when we woke up the next day, people were bitterly, bitterly disappointed that they just hadn't held their nose for that 5% that they didn't quite agree with to vote for Nancy Platts. I do not want that to happen in 2019.
Well, 2017, a general election, there was something called the Progressive Alliance, and the Greens stood down. And whether it helped you get elected or was just your marvellous charisma.
No, of course it helped me. And in the letter that I wrote to Green Party members via Davy Jones, who stood down and was the co-chair at the time, saying thank you straight after the election, I said this was a model of how politics should be done. It is a model that actually we need to start working issue by issue where we agree and coalesce around that. And that's what I've seen and I've pushed here in the City Council as well, where we now have this agreement between Labour running the city and the Greens on not on every area, but on areas we can agree with to ensure our city remains progressive and we tackle climate change. That's what we now need nationally. I would love to see that at a national level. I realise my party is slightly behind the curb on this, but that doesn't mean I think on a local basis we shouldn't be keeping those communication channels open and ensure that we do not wake up regretting what happened the night before on the 13th of December.
Okay, well, it should be said that Labour Party rules don't allow for your candidates to stand out, so no doubt you'll be standing candidates in all three constituencies. Well, we know we've got a sitting MP in Hove.
But we will be focusing our campaign, and I've said this, and this was the national line on Radio 4, we will not focus our campaign in Lewis, we will not focus our campaign in Pavilion, and in those areas we really expect the other parties to step up and win, either where they hold it or in Lewis, to kick out an ERG.
OK, listen, we've come to the end of our allotted span, unfortunately. I should just remind listeners that the full list of candidates can be found on the Brighton Hove City website. And as you know, Lloyd, you've been in this little studio before, we give our guests a musical choice to punctuate the conversation. And perhaps you'd like to tell everyone what your choice has
been. So my musical choice is the Manic Street Preachers. I remember they came to Brighton Centre in 2002, and I then was really keen on them. And this, if you tolerate this, your children will be next, inspired by the Spanish Civil War.
I think there's a message in the title there. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Well, joining me now is Frank Leduc, journalist of this parish, and Jody Doherty-Cove, who many people will see sometimes if they watch webcasts or go to the town hall, sitting on the press desk reporting for the Argus. So although he says he's only a reporter, he does seem to cover political things. So that's why we've got this pair in. And let's kick off and say, well, what are you making of the campaign so far? We've got lots of alliances and all sorts of other things going on which might upset the apple cart. So Jody, tell me, give me your take. Do you think the Brexit Party now is going for Labour votes in the three constituencies is going to pay off?
Well, I think it's going to be very interesting. I think we're going to see pretty much, you know, a microcosm of what's happening across the UK, happening in Brighton, Kemp Town, because you have, you know, all sorts of alliances that potentially aren't happening or could happen there. So you have obviously Labour and Green. Sort of a lot of talk about that at the moment because, you know, with people forming alliances, as with the Brexit Party and the Conservatives. People are worrying that actually, you know, even though most people might want to remain in the area, you might end up with, you know, Joe Miller, just because the vote will be split the other way.
I mean, Joe Miller is a young councillor, so he's got a profile. But do you think, with an 18,000 majority in Hove, do you really think that Peter Kyle is under threat? I'm turning to Frank, who was blushing about his predictions the last time we had a general election. But I'll let him put his neck on the block. What do you think, Frank?
It's only hanging on by a thread here, Geoffrey. This early in the campaign, I hesitate to make predictions after last time. But I think we'll see Peter Kyle back in Hove. Any effort to trigger a ballot there didn't come to fruit in the end because of the timings. I think he's a shoo-in to get back in. I think he's got a better candidate facing him this time from the Conservatives in Robert Nemeth, a credible candidate, also a councillor, and who's worked in the Commons as a researcher first and then as an office manager for Michael Gove, then Mike Weatherly, the last Conservative MP for Hove. So I think that... I think Robert's a good candidate, but I think he's going to struggle to overturn such a big majority by Peter Kyle. I'm almost confident making that prediction that Peter will get back in.
You heard it here, folks, first. But I mean, we've got a Brexit candidate who we interviewed, and I have to say, without sort of damning his chances, when I asked him about his party's policies, and at the time I was recording, they were claiming pitching 600 candidates across the country. It's now pegged back, but they're pegging back with the aim of actually targeting specific Labour Party candidates, and that was a win from the Tories last time. So I'm just wondering whether Robert Nemeth's share of the vote will be dissipated by the intervention of Andy Wood from the Brexit Party.
Short answer? No.
Not a joke.
I don't think so. I mean, Brighton and Hove voted about 70% in favour of Remain. And the three constituencies here, you've got Peter Kyle, who's very pro-EU in Hove, wants a confirmatory referendum. You know, Lloyd is probably pretty similar in Brighton and Kemptown, and Caroline Lucas, well, no one doubts she's a former MEP. She wears her sort of blue heart with its gold stars on her other sleeve, if I can put it like that. The voting demographic across the country is gradually changing between the old left-right spectrum to, at the moment, a bit of a Brexit, Leave, Remain split in many places. I don't really think that's so much of an issue in Brighton and Hove. You know, so many people are on the same page, and those who do want to support a Leave voting candidate, they can do that with the Conservatives, who are being returned on that manifesto to get Brexit done.
Whatever that means, of course. But let's focus a little bit on where it's a bit more interesting in Kemptown, because here we have the last time the Greens stood down, we've got a quite high profile Green candidate who could, and we've got 10,000 votes to play with, could steal votes from Lloyd, and we've got a Brexit candidate who is targeting Labour but could draw votes away from Joe. So Jody, you're sort of kind of nodding.
Yeah, well, I think that's for me, so far in this early stage of the campaign, that's, you know, been some of the really interesting points playing out there. Obviously in 2017 Davy Jones was stood down. In the 2015 election, Nancy Platts lost by,
and that's crotchet, as they say,
by about 400 votes. But, you know, Alex is an exceptional candidate. She has every right to stand, as do the Greens. And, you know, she's arguing, well, you know, there's 10,000, you know, votes to play with that Lloyd has. And so if we're not going to stand in this seat, you know, where can we stand? Because, you know, that is a Labour majority there.
Yeah, I did have one Labour activist suggesting she should pick up her kit and go and stand in Lewis, which is slightly insulting to an independent Green Party in Lewis, who have their own candidate, I guess. But it's I'm just wondering whether a Brexit intervention could open the door for Joe Miller to get in by a slim margin.
Well, Joe's obviously an interesting character.
I have to tell listeners that Frank is sort of screwing up his face, thinking, a bit far-fetched, I think, if I interpret the facial expression.
I think Kemp Town's wide open, because nominations haven't closed when we're recording this, but so we'll have a clearer view by the time they have. But if, for example, Bridget Fishley decides to stand as an independent, if the Brexit Party put their candidate up as well, my suspicion is their votes will be drawn predominantly from people who might otherwise have voted for Joe Miller, Conservative. Again, a young councillor, already a former deputy leader of Lewis District Council at the tender age of 25. You know, up against, on the other side of the spectrum, if you like, Lloyd, who's got a majority that probably surprised a few people last time, himself included, I suspect, nearly 10,000. The Greens did fairly well there the last time they did stand a candidate, and there is a concern that's what split the vote and allowed Simon Kirby to hold the seat in 2015, I think it was. So I think there's a danger on both sides, if you like, that the vote could be diluted. Should Alex stand down? I don't think so. I mean, I know there's some pressure from Labour, and the obvious retort is, well, are you standing down in Brighton Pavilion? And the answer is no, they're not.
I think when we...
What's the point of a political party? It's to stand in elections and to try to hold office.
As listeners will have heard, when we talked to Lloyd Russell Moyle just now, the rules of the Labour Party don't allow candidates to stand down. What they might do is put up what we call in the business paper candidates, and then focus all their resources into Kemp Town or Hove. Although perhaps we'd like to just talk about the unique circumstances, and you referred to them, of the Hove Labour Party. They don't have the wherewithal and the rules to allow these kind of alliances. So the claims that, you know, a Green candidate or a Lib Dem should stand down to make way for the stronger Labour Party is not a reciprocal arrangement that they're offering.
We're seeing more of these deals this time round, and yet actually the Lib Dems would argue they're resurgent compared with the last two general elections when they were...
Resurgent as a result...
From a very low base.
Well, they certainly were hit where it hurts
in
after the coalition.
Yes.
And people don't forget some of their pledges, which were...
I think the tuition fees pledge did a disproportionate amount of harm, because they were targeting a young vote, and those people were disillusioned that pledge was not followed through.
And you have to remember that actually the people who were affected by that had their uni fees tripled, that they're reminded of that every month when the student loans come through. So,
And we are in a university town where we've got about 40,000 students. Whether they will have registered to vote here or go home. Mm. I think the Lib Dems wanted to change the date, and I think they had an eye on the student vote. Whether that would have paid dividends for them, I don't know. And I think also what I've heard is a lot of people they have long memories, and they remember that Joe Swinson was a member of the coalition government, which was responsible for the austerity programme.
I think, to be honest, with no disrespect to the Lib Dems in Brighton and Hove, that they're not relevant in this general election. And I don't mean that unkindly. It's just the numbers. They're just not. They haven't got the numbers on the ground to go knocking doors. They haven't got the numbers, and they haven't got candidates, I don't think, who in the two seats where they're standing are likely to, you know, make a genuine impression.
Well, certainly, the candidate in Pavilion has stood down.
Again.
Mm. But that was a local decision the last time, a local party. This time it's a national agreement. But they haven't stood down in Hove, as far as I know. British is still there. And forgive me, listeners, I can't remember the name of the candidate. And by the way, if you want a full list of candidates standing...
I think it's in, Ben Thomas in Kemp Town.
Ben Thomas. Thank goodness for Jodie. Ben Thomas. Oh, yes, we interviewed Ben. I'm so sorry. I do apologise, Ben. I should have remembered you. Yes, and he gave very good account of himself. He said, trying to recover the situation. But, I mean, I don't know whether they will make a difference or not, and whether they have the manpower, the legs to knock on doors and deliver leaflets and so on. I'm sure that their candidates will give a good account of themselves, although I noticed the Hove candidate got herself into a bit of a pickle complaining that the Argus had used an image of her without her permission.
I better be very careful about what I say here, I think. But, no, it was an interesting Thursday night anyway over online. So.
Yeah. I just wonder, is Caroline Lucas, in your view, a shoo-in? I mean, she had more than 50% of the vote last time round.
I think, you know, it's Caroline Lucas, each election is increasing her vote share. She's proving herself, you know, very capably nationally and campaigning, as I see, you know, covering local issues. She's very engaged locally as well. And I think every time that comes to the election, that hard work that she seems to be putting in at the national level and at the local level seems to be paying off. People, you know, turning up to the ballot boxes and voting for her in increasing numbers each time.
But do you think her profile is likely to, forever and a day, eclipse any other bright candidate? So if Ollie Sykes or Alex Phillips, are they likely to be eclipsed by the bright star that is Caroline Lucas, and the chance of actually getting someone locally elected in one of the other constituencies is a long way off?
Well, I think, you know, obviously Alexandra Phillips, she's proving herself as an MP in waiting, really, in terms of, you know, campaigning on those sort of issues and really sort of, you know, touching at the core base of Green voters and winning over new ones. So, of course, you know, Caroline is a bright light in terms of that regard. But I think, you know, that there is support there for other candidates to come through for the party.
Certainly on the council, Pete West was the first Green MP for a while and...
ever. He was the first Green
councillor. I beg your pardon. He was the first Green councillor for quite some time, but then the party increased its numbers, sort of, I mean, percentage wise, quite. I want to use that Donald Trump word, bigly, they seemed like small numbers. But until the point, 15 years after Pete was first elected, you had a council where the Green Party was the largest party, and I'm not suggesting that's necessarily what's going to happen in Parliament, but I think that. I think people came after Pete, and I think people will come after Caroline Lucas, who have got the credibility to, you know, stand on that stage and fight those battles. And Alex is certainly one of them. She's been elected an MEP. She sits in Brussels or Strasbourg or wherever it is the MEPs do their business. and, you know, she's, you know, again, and she's mayor of Brighton and Hove, although she's standing aside for the duration of this election campaign. And, you know, these are things that, you know, I'm saying them in passing, that have caused some debate locally as well about just how many roles or what roles you should carry out and how. But Alex is a very capable person, and I think that, I suspect she may not win this time in Kemp Town, but there you go, I'm putting my neck back on the line for those awful predictions. But I don't think that means we won't see her do well at some point in the future, whether here or somewhere else.
But I guess Alex Phillips is an interesting example of women making it in politics. So what's coloured the national scene is a lot of women MPs have decided that they've had too much online abuse and physical abuse, you know, Anna Soubry coming out of Parliament and being jostled by leavers. And many women are just turning their faces against getting involved in politics. With candidates like Alex Phillips, and I'm sure there are lots of other examples around the country, they are having to find strength in the support mechanisms around them to be able to realise their ambitions. And there's no reason why women shouldn't hold the highest offices. So we've had two PMs who've been women, apparently, allegedly.
I honestly don't think it makes any difference what gender, what colour, what creed you are going into politics in this country in terms of your ability to do the job. I think some people still have perceptions that we would probably describe as outdated and thoughts about, you know, I've heard Alex criticised for taking on more than one role while she has a young child, and I find myself astonished to hear that kind of criticism. But by all means, criticise her because you don't like her views on X, Y or Z, or that you think someone shouldn't be an MEP and a councillor, if you like, and let her defend herself. But I think to say things like, oh, someone can't do a job because they're a woman or they've got a young baby, etc., is just something I wouldn't give much credence to and expect to hear in this day and age, to be honest.
Yeah. But let's move quickly, because we've got the last 5 minutes of this little chat. There are other things on the horizon other than Brexit. But do you think, in your keen observers, because you're reporting on it, Are any of the other campaigning issues getting through? Is the NHS figuring in people's minds? Social care, all those other things, the environment. We've had Extinction Rebellion demonstrations in the city and in the country. Are these things getting through, or is it all being drowned out by this Brexit?
I think they are coming through, but they're coming through Brexit. You know, so people are saying, well, we need to think about our NHS, but under Brexit we might align ourselves closer to Donald Trump and increase the privatisation. Or, if you think about funding, I think, Liberal Democrats are arguing the position that, actually if we cancel Brexit, we're going to save, this amount of money, so therefore we can invest in the other issues. So those sort of underlying issues are coming through, but I think it's coming through sort of the glass of Brexit, really.
It's been filtered.
Yeah.
What's your view?
I do think Brexit is the dominant issue during this election, but I don't think that it's the only one. And I think that's why, before the election was called, so much effort has been made since Boris Johnson became Prime Minister to make announcements about funding for schools, for the NHS, for policing, and even on housing. So I think that I think Johnson and the people around him are very well aware that they've got to not be dragged into a fight that's just about Brexit, even though that's the primary matter that needs resolving right now, because you've had a parliament that won't vote for a Brexit deal and won't vote for won't annul the referendum vote. So Johnson's argument is, well, we'll get a new parliament and get it done. And I think we've seen actually a lot of people who've opposed him on Brexit are standing down or are no longer have the Conservative Party membership. And I think on the Labour benches as well, we've seen some changes, and it'll be interesting to see what kind of Parliament returns, what kind of Commons we get.
It will. I mean, predictions now at times. Do you think we're going to have a decisive victory for one party, though they've got a majority, or do you think it's going to be a hung Parliament? Jodie, what do you think?
Oh, God. I think as it stands now, I would probably, obviously very hesitantly, say Conservative majority. I think, as it is, I think that they will actually win over some of those Labour seats, and
Frank, Geoffrey, what do you think?
What do I think? I'm the interviewer. I have no opinion, as you know.
Oh God, I think we'll probably see a Conservative majority, and I think that people will have been elected knowing that it's on that mandate of getting this thing called Brexit done.
Okay, listen, we've got to sign off, but thank you so much, gentlemen, for coming in. As I mentioned before, all the candidates can be found on the Brighton Hove website, and I'm using my prerogative to choose the last bit of music, which is called Land of Confusion. There's no message there, by Genesis. Thank you so much for coming in.